I'm speaking with David Wiley, who has been running an introduction to open education course online for the past few years, and he's used different kinds of models. But the course has always been all the materials have been open, and students have participated not just from his institutions, but the version we're talking about today. Also people from other institutions. And so I just asked David to give us a little bit of background on the history of the project and his experience running it.
All right, well, thanks, Philip. The course, as you said, is Introduction to Open Education. As far as I knew, there wasn't a course being offered on this back in 2007 when I started offering the course. And since it was the only one being offered, I thought there might be some general interest in it if I advertised it a little more broadly. And being as the course was about open education, I didn't see any point in needlessly precluding people from participating. So a number of years earlier, I had made a commitment to stop using any kind of fully copyrighted readings or materials in any of the courses I was teaching. And so I already had a wiki set up where I was in the habit of posting my syllabi and the links to all the readings, and using the wiki as a place where students could come and sign up with their names and email addresses and list their blog addresses so I could find the homework that they were writing. So basically just took this same model and extended it out to a lot larger group of people, and made two kinds of invitations. One, I made an invitation on my blog to anyone who wanted to follow along with the course to come and jump in and do the readings and put their blog address on the wiki so that we could get it added to the course aggregator and we'd be able to follow the things that people were writing. But then I also sent emails to friends I knew on faculty at other institutions where there are educational technology programs, basically letting them know that I was teaching the course and that if they had any students that wanted to take it, if they were happy with the student signing up for independent study there and taking the course from me, that at the end of term I would just email a grade to the faculty member and they could assign that grade for the independent study. So students were able to take the course for credit at their institution without having to also apply for admission at mine and pay separate tuition and things like that. So, you know, that's the way the course set up and got structured. If you follow the link to go look at the course, I think it turns out we had about 60 participants overall, only 7 or 8 of which were people from my institution, which was Utah State at the time. And, you know, the most interesting thing that happened to me, from my perspective in teaching this course, was somewhere around, well, actually, I know exactly, it was week 10. There was an assignment, there was a post written by one of the members of an Italian group that was following the course that they called the Week X post. This Week X post was kind of critical of how much reading we were doing and how little time there had been to reflect on what other people were writing, and we were really kind of buried in the reading and writing of kind of the assigned readings and doing your own writing without enough time to really reflect and engage all these other students from different places with interesting points of view. Mm-hmm. And the open nature of the course, sort of following the lesson of the Clue Train Manifesto here, the open nature of the course led to a mini student rebellion, which was led by Antonio, as I recall, from the Italian group, which led then to the entire back third of the syllabus being reworked and rewritten to reflect, you know, the recommendations and comments that students had about something, a way that they thought the course could be improved, you know, so that they were getting a better experience. So that was really, you know, that was quite interesting. The course was, obviously all the content in the course was open, the readings were open, all the writing that the students were doing were open because they were put on blogs. But at some point, even the structuring, the high-level structuring of the course, the kinds of assignments people were doing, the number of assignments they were doing, all of that was actually kind of rewritten midway through the course in conjunction with the students who were participating in the course. And again, led by one of the students, not even at my university, and not even taking the course for credit.
That's incredible. So,
yeah, it was quite an interesting experience. And Antonio and a couple of other people who were not at a university at the end of that course asked if I'd be willing to, well, actually, I think I volunteered at the beginning of the course to make a certificate for people that would just say congratulations on completing the course Intro to Open Ed, and I signed my name on it, but without the name of the university or without any implication that they were getting a university credit for it. And so Antonio took one of those, and a couple of people requested those certificates. And later, one of the main education news outlets here in the U.S., the Chronicle of Higher Ed, wrote a story about that that was titled something like, When Professors Hand Out Their Own Diplomas, Who Needs a University Anymore, or something like that, which caused quite a bit of anxious feeling.
And what's your answer to that question?
Well, I mean, it's funny. In Jeff's article, when you get down to the third paragraph, he finally does say it was just a homemade certificate. But in the title and in the first two paragraphs, he keeps talking about diplomas, like there were, you know, degrees being awarded through this process. When in fact, all that was happening was I was writing a certificate for people saying that they had participated in the course, and it didn't bear any university credit, let alone, lead toward any kind of degree or diploma. So I think the title sort of sensationalized what was actually going on just to draw readership.
Yeah. So you said there were, 60 people. Now, that's a lot of people reading and writing and commenting on each other's work. How much were you able to keep track of what everyone was doing, or did the students kind of, you know, start taking things in their own hands and reviewed each other's work? And
well, I've for a long time I've been interested in this idea. Everybody has different names for it. I call it teacher bandwidth. How many students can you fit through a teacher at a time? You know, in the way, like, bandwidth is normally how much data can you fit down a pipe. And one solution to the teacher bandwidth problem that occurred to me a long time ago is that the thing that scales perfectly with the number of students in terms of capacity is the number of students. So if you design the course in such a way that the students are already supporting and working with and reading and commenting on each other's stuff right from the get-go, then the course can scale to kind of any number of students that you want it to, because you'll always have more students when you have more students. So there are always more people to read the work and comment on the work of the additional people that show up for the class. So I was reading things, a couple hours a week. I was using my aggregator really heavily, trying to pull out some things every now and then that I thought were really particularly interesting and point them out to the rest of the people who were following the course. But I would say on average, maybe 3 or 5 extra hours of work beyond what I would have done if, just with the people who attended the course regularly.
And we're using the Utah State version of your course as the case study in the context of this 6-week course here. But you did also redesign it a little bit to run it again at the new institution where you're based. Can you just say a little bit about the changes you made and what the ideas were behind those changes?
Yeah, so the initial version of the course is structurally very traditional. Week 1, week 2, read this, here are the discussion questions. Do some writing where you think about these questions and read what other people are writing and connect and engage with them. The new redesign of the course that I'm doing at Brigham Young University, and it's still in process right now. Basically, I was trying to explore ideas of how to help people support each other more effectively. And when you think about online spaces where there are big groups of people and they support each other rather effectively, one of the first things that comes to my mind is massively multiplayer games, and particularly the guild structure within those games. So I wanted to try to redesign the course as a massively multiplayer game. So if you visit the syllabus for the course now, what you'll see is that after 3 or 4 weeks of kind of very quick, high-level introductory material about the different kinds of things that happen in the domain of open education, each of the students in the course is forced at that point to choose a character class to play for the remainder of the course. So they can be either a bard, who in this case is a person that really is steeped in the politics and the history and the tradition and knows the names of all the people, knows where all the projects are, and is it can be kind of the storyteller and the teller of the history. So there's the bard, there is the artisan being a person who really has kind of the production skills around digital video or HTML production or podcasting or whatever kind of production skills you might need to produce OERs or produce open course. There is a merchant class, which is a person dedicated to thinking about sustainability issues, looking at business models, thinking about how do you run over the long term a project whose main goal is to give things away for free. And then there's a monk class, and the monk class really focuses in on the arcana of copyright law and kind of the religious feelings around things like the non-commercial clause and some of those sorts of issues. Now, interestingly, again, in this version of the course, you know, students got engaged pretty early and said, there's actually another character class that you haven't given us access to that a couple of us want to play. And that is the rogue character class. And the rogue is sort of like an artisan in that the rogue is a person with a variety of digital materials production sorts of skills. But in the case of these two students that wanted to play the rogue, what they really wanted to do was go around to some open projects that by license are open, but in terms of the technology they use and the way they've structured their content, make it very, very difficult for anyone else to repurpose or reuse any of their materials. So what they basically wanted to do is they wanted to use their skills to jailbreak a bunch of open educational resources, which is kind of a funny term to say that you'd have to jailbreak OERs. But when you look at the way some of these sites are put together and the sorts of technology they use, it's pretty clear that even though they have an open license, they have no intent on letting you download and remix and repurpose their material. So,
sure.
So here again is another case of the course being kind of radically open, where there's a new character class added. And then for each of these character classes, you know, they have a different set of things that they read. They have a different set of assignments that they do, like the skills tree that a character class in a traditional massively multiplayer game would traverse. You know, the wizard learns different skills than the fighter does, and those two learn different skills than the healer does and whatnot. So the merchant reads things about, the merchant studies sustainability models and thinks about different kinds of issues and writes different things each week than the monk does, who's really thinking about copyright and licensing and things like that. And so the course is structured around a series of six quests, and the quests become increasingly difficult, and by the fifth and sixth quests, there's really so much work and so many moving parts in terms of the kinds of skills you have to draw on that it really requires a guild with at least one member of each of the different character classes involved to be able to have a realistic chance of succeeding in the quest. So that's how the course has been redesigned this year. And the participation rates this year are much lower, I guess partly because most of the people who were interested in taking a course like this took it last year when I offered it last year. But we'll see how that works out.
I mean, it sounds absolutely fascinating, I have to say. So, it would be interesting to explore other potential reasons why there's less interest. Could be that it's a lot more work, or people maybe can't get their head around how it works yet. They want to see people run through it once. But one of the things that you mentioned, the rogue character, I think is really relevant in the context of this Mozilla course here, because as we're looking at open tech and open licensing, we're also very interested in the relationship between the two. Right, where people are using open technology, but maybe they're not aware of the open licensing that they should be applying to their materials. And then the other way, where they're using open licenses, but actually the technology is, you know, makes it very difficult to reuse things or remix them or repurpose them. So that's the perfect example for some of the things we're going to speak about in the next 6 weeks.
Yeah, we actually, some new work that I did for the course this year, and you can... The first seven times the course met, it meets twice a week, I was presenting kind of high-level overviews of issues and videoing those, and they're available on iTunes that people can watch. But we came up with an analysis framework for looking not just at licensing, but looking at other issues, kind of a four-step framework for looking at how actually reusable, remixable, and repurposable OERs are, once the license considerations are aside. So I can send you a link to that, and maybe we can hook that up.
Please. I think what I'll also do is I'll look at those iTunes videos, and I'll stick them into the different weeks of this course. You know, if there's a presentation on licensing, I'll add it as background reading to this course as well.
Okay, very good.
Cool, man. Okay, well, thank you very much for your time, David. And I'll put this up on the wiki probably tomorrow morning.
Sounds great. Thanks.